Kia ora, greetings everyone. It's fantastic to have such a good turnout, particularly for a session on aid. We organised the conference earlier this year with assistance from a range of people represented here, actually, and organisations, and I thought we might get 150 if we were very lucky. But in fact, I think 350 people registered. And it was a stunning turnout and a wonderful conference, and thank you to those of you here who contributed to that event. And it's now my pleasure to welcome Terence Wood. Terence will be known to many of you here, having been a senior research analyst for what was called New Zealand Aid, and is currently a PhD student at the Australian National University, and I'm sure we'll say a bit more about that in the course of his talk. He's going to be addressing the question of, is economic development an appropriate central focus for an aid program? And we're going to have a presentation by Terence and then a short commentary, and it will be short, Jeff, from Jeff Bertram. and then I'll throw the floor open for questions and discussion. And I suggest the new people coming, if you can just feel free to go around the back and over to the left. Terence, thank you very much for coming. We look forward to what you have to say. Thank you.
So the fact that the microphone is pointing away from me and towards you, that might help.
If it's on.
Is it on? If it's not on, we can soon fix that.
How do we...
Yep.
That's the light. Hello? No?
No? It's very mic on.
All mics off.
Mic on. Nothing.
Oh, it's working.
You think that's working? Yes.
Right. Okay then, thank you all for coming along. I actually I convinced my parents to attend this morning because I was so desperate to pad out the numbers, so it's interesting to see that wasn't really necessary, although thanks Mum and Dad for coming along anyhow. thank you for sacrificing what's such a nice lunch break too. So as Jonathan said, I'm a PhD student at ANU, a former research analyst at NZAID, and I'm going to speak here today in a talk that's been organised by the IPS, so thank you to the IPS for organising it, but also been facilitated by NZAIDS, which is a new think tank, I guess, which we're trying to set up to promote dialogue and discussion on aid and development work in New Zealand. There's a sign-up sheet coming round. Please only sign your name and email address to that sheet if you'd like to receive emails from us in the future, but that's a way that you can find out more about our organisation. You can also have a look at the website, which is up there on the whiteboard behind me. And I guess one of the important things about NZAIDS is it's something we're trying to set up to foster dialogue and discussion about development issues. And very much in line with the ethos of NZAIDS, my talk today isn't meant to be the final word on the issue of economic development and aid, but rather I'm going to put some points out there and hopefully through that serve as a starting point for further discussion. Obviously, the subject of whether economic development is an appropriate central focus for an aid program is something that's of relevance here in New Zealand. We've seen a recent change in the mandate of the New Zealand Government Aid Program to a core to a mandate which includes a core focus on economic development. But it's not something that's solely relevant to New Zealand. There are other aid programs around the world which have similar mandates. And so, without further ado, I'll leap into my talk. But the first thing I want to do is just give you a couple of definitions so you understand what I'm speaking about when I'm talking about economic development and development. So I've got a definition of economic development up there on the board behind me. It's a fairly conventional definition. Economic change in countries and regions leading to increased material prosperity. Now that's not exactly the same as growth in GNI per capita or growth in GDP per capita, but it's approximately equal to it or similar to it. And by virtue of the fact that most of the studies that I'm going to use proxy economic development using statistics on GDP and GNI per capita, I'm also going to make a lot of reference to those terms or concepts. Then I've got development as my second definition, and as you can see, it's obviously something considerably broader than economic development alone. Definitions of development are contested. There's very little consensus, but what I hope I've achieved today is to provide a definition that's broad enough that most people in the audience would find it acceptable. And I've defined it there as a process through which human suffering is reduced and through which human welfare and well-being is increased. All right, so let's see how these two concepts fit together in the new mandate of NZAID. So this is taken from the About page of the New Zealand Aid Program. Forgive me if I keep referring to NZAID. Old habits die hard, particularly when you're nervous and in front of a crowd of people. But let's have a look at the mandate of the new New Zealand Aid Program. And then we've got sustainable economic development is a central focus for the New Zealand Aid Program mandate of supporting sustainable development in order to reduce poverty and contribute to a more secure, equitable and prosperous world. And what I've tried to do is unpack that a little bit with a diagram. And there's several key points of the diagram that I'd like to point out. So as you can see from the mandate as it was as on the website, the ultimate goal of the aid program, the ultimate ends that aid and New Zealand aid is still meant to be trying to promote, is development more broadly put, or poverty reduction. But importantly, the immediate goal, or the central means for achieving that end, has now been shifted to economic development. And that means that aid work, in a variety of different areas, is presumably going to be evaluated in terms of its input to economic development, or at least primarily evaluated in terms of its economic development. If you look at the website of the aid program, you'll still see that there is some reference to, I've got human capital there, but things like education and health being valued for their own worth alone. So they're not exclusively being evaluated in terms of their contribution to economic development. But you see increasing information suggesting that one of the key reasons for engaging in these sectors, and as well as areas like governance, is for what it can do for economic development. And at the same time, we've got something there that I call the productive sector, but I guess I mean through by that aid which is invested in economic areas or areas that might directly stimulate economic development. And I think it's fair to say that a shift to a core focus on economic development must mean more and more of our aid program going to what I've called the productive sector there. There's two important things that leap out of this graph, or at least leap out to me. The first of these is that there's an assumption buried in there, and that is that economic development itself actually leads to better development outcomes, poverty reduction, improvements in other aspects of development more generally. And the second assumption is that aid-funded work can actually promote economic development. And so I've used those two assumptions to provide me with three questions. And I think in answering these questions, I can give you a pretty good idea of whether economic development is an appropriate focus for an aid program. The first question is, does economic development lead to development more generally? Because if it doesn't, then you'd have to say that it would be a poor focus for an aid program that ultimately still wants to promote development and reduce poverty. The second question, can aid actually promote economic development? Because if it can't, well, you'd have to say we're wasting our aid money if we focus it in that area. And then I've got a third question here, which is aid more effective in promoting other aspects of development? Because even if economic development leads to development, and even if aid can do something by means of promoting economic development, if aid is much more effective in promoting development when it's focused in areas that have little or nothing to do with economic development, then you'd have to say, in terms of cost efficiency, we'd be better to focus our aid away from economic development. So those are the three questions I'm going to take you through today. The first of these, does economic development lead to development more generally? As I defined development more generally, I guess a fairly holistic term, and owing to sort of time constraints, I'm going to narrow my focus somewhat, and I'm just going to have a look at economic development's impact on poverty and economic development's impact on health. So two aspects of development more generally. The first of these, so does economic development lead to poverty reduction? What I've got behind me is a graph on the board, strikingly clear really, isn't it? And this is a graph from a research paper by Art Cray, who's an economist at the World Bank. And what his paper does is it looks at the relationship between economic growth or economic development and poverty reduction. What you can see on the x-axis is a level of economic growth or a level of average income growth. And on the y-axis, you can see headcount poverty reduction. And you can see a fairly steep downward slope, and it's a reasonably strong correlation if you look at the R-squared figure. And what that tells us is that economic development is indeed fairly strongly correlated with poverty reduction, or economic growth is indeed fairly strongly correlated with poverty reduction. Now, to preempt a question that might be coming from the audience, true, this is a paper by the World Bank, and everyone knows that the World Bank has a certain agenda to push. However, here's a quote from another paper, and this is a paper written by Mark Weisbrot and Dean Baker. And they're two left-leaning American economists who like next to nothing that the World Bank does. They're strong critics of the World Bank, And this is actually from a paper where they critique another World Bank paper looking at economic growth and development. So they got the quote up there behind me. The paper's main finding, that there is generally a positive correlation between economic growth and the income of the poor, is no surprise. In fact, it is difficult to imagine who would argue that there were no such correlation. So I've just plugged that quote up there to give you a sense of, I guess, the breadth of opinion amongst economists from all different parts of the political spectrum, or consensus, that economic development really is strongly related to poverty reduction. On average, I should point out. Because my next slide, I'm just going to try and unpack that on that average. As you can see from this slide, this is from a Tim Besley study of economic development or income, economic growth in India and poverty, looking at the relationship between income growth and poverty reduction in India. And this graph I've chosen, I think, is interesting because it shows two things. Once again, so you've got economic development, really, or income per capita income growth on the x-axis, headcount poverty reduction on the y-axis. And what you can see in the graph is something very similar to that which you could see in the Art Cray graph, and that is that there's a strong correlation. Now these are the different data points on the graph are in the different Indian states. You can see a strong correlation between those states that grew faster and those states that did a better job at reducing poverty. And yet at the same time, if you look at the graph, you can see there's quite a bit of variance around the average trend there. So right at the top there, we've got Kerala, which did a reasonably good job in terms of economic development over the 40 years that the study was undertaken, the 40 years that produced the data that the study used. Did a reasonably good job of economic growth, but it did an exceptional job when it came to reducing headcount poverty, an almost 60% reduction in headcount poverty in Kerala. On the other hand, if you look at Kerala, if you look at Haryana, another Indian state, it grew even more rapidly, and yet the reduction in headcount poverty was significantly less. In fact, it was under 20%, approximately 15%. So I'm just showing you this slide to emphasise the point that while on average economic development is almost certainly a good thing in terms of poverty reduction, you do get considerable variance around that average, which means that economic development can do a better or worse job when it comes to reducing poverty. So that's poverty. What about health? Now, I've got another graph for you here. And what this graph shows is the relationship between life expectancy and level of GNI per capita. The x-axis has GNI per capita, gross national income per capita, and purchasing power parity dollars. The y-axis has life expectancy in terms of years. And what you see here is what is a sort of stylized fact well known in development economics called the Preston curve. And what you see is that for poor countries, the relationship between GNI per capita and health is very, very strong. Intriguingly, it breaks down at about 30,000 purchasing power parity dollars per capita, and in wealthier countries, there's no strong correlation between wealth and life expectancy. But for the world's poorest countries, the correlation is indeed very strong. So this itself is suggestive, I guess, that once again, there might be a strong relationship between improvements in economic development and improvements in health outcomes. Of course, all I'm showing here is a correlation. It doesn't necessarily prove causation. And indeed, within this correlation, causation probably runs both ways. That is, getting healthy is a good way of improving your odds of getting wealthy. But also, there's a relative consensus, I guess, amongst development economists that getting wealthy is also a good way of improving your health outcomes for a country. And here we go. Here's a quote from the Spence report. We can say with confidence that economic growth improves health. However, once again, all that's on average. So I just thought I'd highlight three different countries. The data points on this graph are countries, of course, to show that even an average, or the average in health is very similar to the average in poverty reduction, and there's considerable variation around average trends. So we can see down the bottom here, we've got Equatorial Guinea. It's actually relatively wealthy in terms of GNI per capita as far as developing countries go, and yet the life expectancy in Equatorial Guinea is less than 50. Meanwhile, right up at the top of the graph, we've got Costa Rica, which is actually poorer than Equatorial Guinea, but has a life expectancy of almost 80 years. And indeed, Costa Rica's life expectancy is higher than that of the United States of America, a country that is, as you can see from the graph, dramatically wealthier. So this illustrates another point, I guess, and that is that while economic development is a good way of improving health, once again, economic development doesn't necessarily guarantee health improvements. And similarly, even countries with a relatively low level of economic development can, up to a point, improve the health outcomes experienced by their citizens. And I just plugged in another quote there from Angus Deaton, a well-regarded development economist, and he's got a quote which says, economic growth frequently needs help to guarantee an improvement in population health. So a bit like poverty, there's a relationship there, but there is some variance around the relationship, and that's somewhat important. So where does that leave us at this point? I think we can say with considerable confidence, and actually, while I've just used health and poverty reduction, you can look at other aspects of development more broadly put, and you find a similar relationship. Democracy is more likely to flourish in wealthier countries. That's something that's reasonably well established. Increased wealth provides countries with more money to spend on things like education, once again. So that's something that's more likely to be enhanced, I guess, by economic development. So it's a relationship that's not just limited to health and poverty by any means. So I think from those facts, we can conclude that economic development does, on average, lead to better development outcomes. But that the extent to which it does varies, and also that, and I think this is important, some good can be done in the absence of economic development. So economic development really is something, but it's not everything, and it's not the only thing. And that's something that I'll return to a little bit later in the talk. I did want to leave you with one final slide. As I look at it now, I'm not even sure if I spelt sovereignty right, but if I haven't, forgive me. I could sort of exit out of the slide view and put a spell checker on it, but I won't. One final point in favour of economic development. This is a graph charting the economic fortunes of South Korea from 1969 to 1983. The blue line on the graph is ODA per capita as received by South Korea. The red line on the graph is South Korea's GDP per capita. And what you can see here is a development success story in practice, or as it happens, as it unfurled. From 1969 to 1983, South Korea got steadily richer. And as it did, and almost as you'd expect, South Korea became steadily less reliant on aid over that period of time. Now, that shifted a little bit during the Asian financial crisis when it had to be bailed out by the IMF, if I recall correctly, Jeff. Yeah. But nevertheless, the point is, by 1983, South Korea wasn't really reliant on international aid at all to meet its core government expenditures. Now, this, I think, is an important point, because aid in the past has proven to be rather volatile. It's often been coupled with inappropriate conditions. And you'd have to conclude that if you're a country and if you're concerned with your own sovereignty at all, you'd have to say that it's pretty important that you do try and become independent of a need for aid as soon as possible. And while, as I said, you can improve health outcomes of your poor country without necessarily increasing economic development, odds are, if you're a very poor country, the only way you're going to be able to do that is by being reliant on aid. And so if you think it's optimal that at some point in time your country ought to be independent of the whims of aid donors, then you'd have to say that economic development is fairly important for achieving that. So that takes us to question two. And thus far it seems like economic development is potentially a pretty good central focus for an aid program. But now the next question we need to ask is whether aid can actually promote economic development. And this is something that economists have been researching now for, well, at least since the early 1980s and probably earlier. It's been something that's been studied with all manner of different methodological approaches and all sorts of fancy econometrics. And the short answer to the question whether aid can promote economic development is no one's entirely sure. Indeed, the results are pretty ambiguous. The best available recent study suggests that there's a small positive aid has a small positive impact on economic development in general, on average, across countries. However, this graph that I put up here is from a different paper, a recent paper in Comparative Politics, in the journal Comparative Politics, which I think is an interesting graph, and I think it's also important because it helps unpack average relationships and starts to look at whether the impact of aid on economic development might vary from country to country. What you can see here on your x-axis, you've got countries ranked in terms of personalism. I won't get into the technical details of that, but that's a ranking based around the different political structures in the aid recipient countries. Countries which are highly personalist tend to be highly clientelist and based around strong personal relationships between politicians and voters. Countries which are not particularly personalist tend to have more informal political institutions. What you see here is for the median country, the relationship between aid and economic development is not statistically different from zero. But what you also see is that for countries with strongly personalist political systems, the relationship between aid and economic development is actually a negative relationship. That is, aid seems to impede economic development. On the other hand, for countries with strong political institutions or non-personalist political institutions, the relationship between aid and economic development is a positive one. And I've put this graph up because I think it illustrates an important point, something that comes out in a range of within-country studies. The impact of aid on economic development probably varies from country context to country context. In some countries, aid is likely to be able to promote economic development. In other countries, it's probably quite almost certainly liable to fail at that task. And that, I think, is an important point. So to summarise, my answer to question two, can aid promote economic development? Possibly, on average. There's probably a small positive relationship there. But that average really needs to be unpacked and examined on an individual country level. And when you do, you get an answer that suggests that aid can promote economic development in some countries, but not in others. So that leads us to our third question. So aid's impact on economic development seems kind of ambiguous. Maybe it's more effective in promoting other aspects of development. And I thought I'd tackle this question once again by looking at the area of health. I think, as all of you would agree, it's an essential component to development. And what I've got here on the board behind me is a quote from a study looking at the impact of malaria reduction programs in Zambia. That's the core focus of the study. It's not actually a focus on aid effectiveness as such, but a focus of the effectiveness. It's a study that focuses on the effectiveness of anti-malaria programs. However, the vast majority of anti-malaria programs in Zambia are funded by aid. Indeed, the vast majority of health work in Zambia is funded by aid. And here's a quote from the study. This study was published, it was an NBER working paper from last year. I'll read it to you. There are different ways to quantify the magnitude of Zambia's recent success in health improvement. The reduction in under 5 mortality represents approximately 25,000 children's lives saved per year. To compare the mortality improvement to more economic outcomes, we can do a back-of-the-envelope calculation using the Human Development Index, which weighs economic and non-economic characteristics into an overall measure of quality of life. Using the formula for the HDI, one can calculate the amount of income growth that would be equivalent to a particular rise in life expectancy at birth. A conservative estimate, using just the data on under 5 mortality, is that life expectancy at birth in Zambia rose by 2.25 years over the period 2000 to 2007. Plugging this into the HDI formula shows that an equivalent rise in HDI would be achieved if income per capita grew by 25%. So that's a fairly dramatic success for aid-funded health work in the country of Zambia. Now, to be fair, the paper then goes on to examine the household survey data in more detail, and it revises some, at least in more detail with respect to malaria, and it revises some of its conclusions. Some go down, some go up. Nevertheless, with respect to the specific focus of malaria, it still concludes that that work had a substantial impact on mortality and health in Zambia. So, I mean, I think that's a quote which I've chosen because it reflects something that is fairly apparent in a range of other studies, from other within-country case studies to cross-country regression work, that shows that AIDS impact in the area of health is considerably less ambiguous than AIDS impact in economic development. And this isn't to say that every aid-funded health program out there is guaranteed to work, but rather that aid seems to have a much better track record in the area of health. Now, this is not only true in health, it's also true in education, where, at least with regards to quantity of education provided, aid has significant success to its name. And interestingly, there are recent studies coming out that show that aid has been quite effective in a range of areas, including in reducing conflict in recently democratized countries. So what a whole body of evidence is showing is that aid can be effective in all manner of aspects of development not directly related to economic development. It's not guaranteed to be, but it seems like its potential for success is higher in these areas than it is in fostering economic development alone. Great. So where does that leave us? What does it all mean? I think we can take us some concluding points from this talk. One, economic development is generally a good thing. Two, aid, however, is not guaranteed to bring economic development about. Its track record's not great, and it seems to vary in impact from country to country. And three, aid has a considerably better track record in other sectors that contribute to human welfare, such as health. And
what does that mean? Well, I tried to show this on a diagram behind me. I'm not sure if I'm successful.
But really, in my opinion, having reviewed the evidence, a far better mandate for an aid program would be one that didn't mandate a particular core focus in any specific sector or in any specific area, but rather just let the aid program, gave it a broad overarching goal of improving development more generally, but then let the aid program select the areas that it was going to work on, and importantly, let it select those areas based on context. And context would mean two things: being aware of the country context and also being aware of the sort of potentials of the type of aid that you're giving. So to tie this into recent examples from the New Zealand case, I'm not 100% certain of this, but it was suggested to me that our volunteer program, BSA, is now going to be fully focused on economic development work. Well, there's an example of a bad idea. If you can... I'm glad you're in agreement with me on that. I only came to that conclusion about 15 minutes before the talk, but anyhow. There's an example of a bad idea. I mean, or at least it seems to be a very questionable idea. The first thing you want to do is think about what sort of work a volunteer is really going to be best at doing. And then focus your aid program, focus your volunteer sending program on making sure they're doing that type of work rather than trying to shoehorn them into economic development work. Similarly, I mean, the change in funding to what was formerly known as the Koha Fund or Koha PIC Fund to the Sustainable Development Fund. This is funding for New Zealand NGOs doing development work overseas. Once again, I mean, unless you're absolutely certain that NGOs are going to be really good at doing economic development work, why sort of do a Cinderella Sisters type activity and try and force the foot of NGO work into the shoe of economic development? Far better to think about what NGOs are best at doing and then let them engage in that type of work. And then for all types of aid work, think about the country context where you're working. In some countries, which are well-governed and where things tend to work generally, by all means, go ahead and try and promote economic development. But in other countries, and Papua New Guinea springs to mind, I think focusing too hard on economic development is going to be a fool's errand, really, and it's only going to lead to failure. Much better, if you can, to let country context and aid context dictate your core focus. All right, that's all I have to say. I'll hand you over now to Jeff, and you'll probably, if track record is anything to go by, explain to me where I'm wrong and why I'm wrong. Maybe I'll get lucky just this once.
All right, well, thank you very much indeed, Terry. Yes, I was thinking, as you mentioned VSA, of the possibility of a foreign minister of a very small country suggesting that Médecins Sans Frontières should focus on economic development. Anyway, sorry.
You keep talking for a moment, because I've got to get rid of this.
Dr. Jeff Bertram was a senior lecturer in economics at his university, has done a lot of work on development economics, and Jeff, 6 minutes.
Yeah, okay, it looks like I might have lost my slides. So that's all right. I'll talk without them. Yep.
All right.
All right. Well, I guess this exhibit's why Terence was one of my favourite students when he did my development economics honours course. Because what we did try to do in that course was look heavily at the evidence and try to dig out the econometrics and then draw some conclusions from it. So, Terence, I'm perfectly happy with what you've done so far, and I'm not going to disagree with your conclusions. I just worry that you're not quite radical enough. And so, just to address a few of the things that I'd like to maybe modify what you said. First one is on the language. That word development is an absolute minefield. And as you were talking, I was conscious of the way you kept on saying development and then having to qualify which sort of development it was, because there was economic development here and development there, and they were different things. And my advice always is, and it is in this case very strongly, when writing about this stuff, distinguish between economic growth and development. Rather than trying to distinguish between economic development and development, what the sort of economists that you're concerned with mean when they talk about economic development is actually economic growth. It's not a sort of approximate equality, and it's best usually to focus on the question of economic growth there, development here. Development can be specified in terms of things like the human development indicators, so that all the welfare categories that you listed as outcomes from development, I would package into development more tightly, I think. And the point here is to try to clarify the real division between the narrowly focused growth economics literature and the extremely broadly focused development literature, in which many economists participate. And because economists come in a whole lot of shapes and sizes, you'll find us claiming economic development to encompass everything under the sun if you push us far enough. So it's best, I think, to have a broad church on development and a narrow church on economic growth. And then I think to categorise the New Zealand government's position as being narrow church in the growth environment, and appropriating to that the language of the broad church of development as if it's a way of getting legitimacy for a program that actually is extremely narrow in its focus. And so I think trying to clarify the language actually sharpens the criticism in a way that can be quite useful. Personalism is a worry. And if you go around the Pacific and ask, are these economies characterised by high personalism or high impersonalism? The answer tends to come back, these are quite personalistic economies. And if you have a relationship which shows that the marginal impact of aid actually drops as you move towards a more personalistic environment, I think it's important then to go on from that to say, now, the New Zealand aid program is targeted at the following countries. Where do they fall on that personalism and non-personalism spectrum? And if they fall at the personalism end, are they outliers in that broader worldwide relationship that you show, or do they fall within it? Insofar as aid has a lower growth-promoting effect in personalistic economies, it's a particular concern for the New Zealand aid program insofar as it's being increasingly focused into economies with that sort of environment. Now, I'm not sure how many people would agree with me that there's quite a high degree of personalism in the Pacific. I think it's a different sort of personalism from what you find in, say, the Middle East or, say, the Caribbean. I think personalism does come in many flavours, but it's nevertheless a worry when you have results of the sort that you show. I had a slide, and it's not. I didn't manage to get it up, and we don't have a pen, do we? So I want you to imagine a slide on the screen in which I try to categorise the way you can model the relationships that Terence is talking about. Right. So over here on the left-hand side of the screen is a box that says aid. And in the middle of the screen there is a box that says economic growth. And at the right-hand side of the screen there's a box that says human development indicators and Millennium Development Goal indicators, all those things which are the ultimate targets. And then arrows run from box to box, rather like the first slide that Terence put up. And if that's a good model, if you go from aid to growth to the Millennium Development Goals and the human development indicators, then the New Zealand government can mount quite a strong analytical case for focusing its aid on growth, as you said. An alternative possibility would be to say aid is here, the human development indicator and Millennium Development Goals are here in the middle, and economic growth is out there. And in that case, you could have arrows running there and there, and that would be consistent with the evidence that you arrayed today. All right. So just take those two and think about them for a moment. The first one, which says aid goes to growth, goes to the HDIs, is empirically reasonable on the right-hand side, but empirically absolutely lousy on the left-hand side. And I think Terence has been far too kind in conceding that aid promotes growth. The general literature, as I read it, says it doesn't. Now, there are some papers that Terence cites. The one that he gives credence to is by Aunt Jones and others in the Journal of Comparative Politics. And the one which he therefore is putting aside is Rajan and Subramanian's Aid and Growth, What Have We Learned? from the Review of Income and Wealth, I think, from memory. And of the two papers, I would tend to think I find the Rajan Subramanian paper more solid than the Jones one. I mean, this is personal preference, but do be really careful. You've got to know that as soon as you say aid helps growth, you've got to go and pick selectively from the literature to find economists who happen to have stumbled on the results you want. And if we had a tournament, I reckon I could get a draw, and I could actually hope to get a win by just throwing backwards and forwards citations from the literature of heavyweight economists on the two sides of the debate. And as you go further and further down that literature and further back into the mist of time, more and more and more of the economists who think aid helps growth are ones who are coming from a prior belief that aid ought to help growth because it sounds intuitively plausible. And they bring to the econometric work a prior view that indeed aid will help growth. And I think it's sort of an open-minded look at the data does tend to drag you, in my view, towards the other thing, which is a puzzle. Aid ought to help growth. All my intuitions say aid should help growth. I reckon I ought to be able to design an aid program that will boost growth. I reckon I could take McKelly by the throat and tell him how to do it. But a lot of people and me have had a go at this, and they haven't come back with a result. So I think we've got to say the aid growth linkage is being unproved. You've got to drop it out of your story. And that brings me to the second model. Your human development indicators go in the middle. Aid goes there with an arrow pointing in here. Growth goes there with an arrow pointing in there. If you get growth, that's great, and it will improve your outcomes. But if you've got aid to dispense, sending it all the way around through the back door and then hoping to get a result is a really poor way to go about it. And of all countries where the government has had a lot of talking in the last 20 years about dealing directly with problems rather than going through indirect mechanisms, New Zealand's got a long track record of talking about doing things direct by going to the distortion, going to the source, getting a bang for your buck by taking your buck and applying it where it matters. So to me, the new aid policy direction is actually a puzzle. I don't know how the New Zealand government thought its way to that. Unless it got there by assumption, by prior belief, rather than by evidence. So this is where I think John Overton would be helpful, because I haven't actually worked personally on the evidence for the New Zealand aid program and the growth performance of the targeted countries. And there's actually an econometric work to be done. If somebody wants to get into it, there's a good doctorate there on the actual econometrics of what outcomes have come from the New Zealand aid program. Now, Jonathan's going to shut me down, but I've got two other things I do want to say. So, very quickly. Number one, the Preston curve that Terence put up, the one which shows very, very steep relationship between income and health outcomes, and then a big overarching result at the top. That tail of the Preston curve, it's hard for me to say this shows a strong causal relationship from income to health, even when I look at it. What it says to me is you can get enormous improvements in health with very small increments to income. And the other chart that he didn't put up, which is about happiness and the relationship between income and happiness. And he and Terence said, well, I think there's a positive relationship between income and happiness. If you look at that chart, if anybody's got the paper, between $0 and $10,000 per head, the statistical relationship between income and happiness isn't there. Once you get above $10,000 per head, the relationship kicks in. I know that that's not what some of the other studies you cite find, and I do agree that Stevenson and Wolfers spend 100 pages of the Brookings Economic Papers getting actually the result that income does correlate to happiness. But your use of evidence in the paper, you've got a chart there that doesn't show a statistically significant relationship. It actually shows that you can get enormous happiness gains with no income gains, or even at lower levels of income. And looking at your Preston chart, you'd get the same feeling. There's an enormous amount of work to be done on the bottom tail of the Preston curve. And that's where putting aid directly in can actually look to get big results by actually pushing countries up at the same level of income to higher levels of happiness, health, education, and so on. And I don't know if any of you have seen George Kenney's new book, It's just come out and it was reviewed in Foreign Policy a couple of weeks ago. But Kenny has written a whole book now called Getting Better, in pretty much on the subject of what's happened to life expectancy, education, other indicators of human welfare, human development indicators, over the last 20 or 30 years across the world economy, and finds a lot of it absolutely independent of income growth, that it's achievable directly by simply the arrival of cheap health care, better public health practices and so on. In other words, there is big bang for the buck to be had outside the growth arena. And that, I think, if you'd actually gone for the kill on your conclusions, you could have made a much stronger conclusion out of that. And the final one, aid isn't always money. You've treated aid as being as if it's money spent on things. But a lot of aid is in kind. And right now in Libya, you're watching aid in kind being delivered. It's being delivered in pursuit of an objective that wasn't on any of the human development indicator lists. There's talk about civil liberty and the rule of law and the democratic process and all sorts of political goals and civil liberty goals and goals that are entirely legitimate for human societies to aspire to, which we usually package along with development. And New Zealand actually does a couple of pretty good things that don't turn up in the aid budget, but which do contribute on that sort of front, and our willingness to host migrant communities in the Pacific, I put right at the top of my list. I mean, I think we get more development bang for the buck in the Pacific on a whole range of indicators outside the HDIs as well, from actually helping free up the regional labour market and help remittances to flow, than we do from actually pouring money directly in. And sovereignty, which Terence mentioned, is after all something that costs you. And so we subsidise. Yep, come on.
You say here. No, you say here.